Away, Hugh.
Thank you, Harry. Everybody can hear me. Okay, so I'm going to warn you that I'm a fast talker. I apologize for that, but I try to keep the momentum going. But feel free to stop me if you have a question, and that's fine. And then I'll just skip parts later on because I put too many slides in the talk. All right, so preamble. There's, you know, a pretty strong consensus about how much stuff there is in the universe. And by that same consensus, we understand 5%. So 95% of the universe is a mystery to us, which is something that we are trying to fix. A large fraction of that component is dark matter. And you'll probably see many of these talks before, so I won't dwell on the evidence for dark matter. I'll just point out my personal favorite, which is the large-scale structure. Is there a pointer or anything?
Darn it. Okay, so Jeff, do you have one?
I don't know.
There's a stick right there.
Sticks are great.
Okay.
So the point here is that if you try to model the history of our universe and you don't put any dark matter, you do not create structure. So dark matter was the glue with which galaxies and clusters of galaxies could form. And if you don't have any of that stuff, then we know we wouldn't be here. So the dark matter is a key part of this. But it's true that this evidence is consistent across all scales, from galactic to cosmological. And it's a pretty solid part of the cosmological model. So we believe it exists, but we don't know what it is. And so what is it? Well, what do we know? Well, we know it interacts gravitationally. That's how we have seen evidence for it. We know it's dark in the sense that it's not interacting with light or electromagnetism, at least in the usual way. We know it's going to be nearly collisionless. We know it's slow. So you can talk to your theory colleagues and ask them, well, what could that be? And the answer is they could come up with many, many things that could be. Axions are a very good one. Machos, champs, some other things. We often talk about WIMPs. But the point is that this is not in the standard model. So this is new physics. There is nothing in the regular particles that we know and love that can explain the dark matter. So this is really probing beyond standard model physics. And if we discover something, it's a new sort of view into the world that we didn't have before. So it's really interesting stuff to look for. The most discussed candidate, and the one I will probably focus on today, is the WIMP, or the weakly interacting massive particle. And really what I want to focus on here is that this is it's a thermal relic. So the idea is that these were produced during the Big Bang, and in the early universe when it was hot, were in equilibrium with the normal matter. So there was some connection with normal matter. But as the universe expanded and cooled, eventually this stuff decoupled from the normal matter. You could no longer create it. And it would just annihilate. And so there was some period in the expansion of our history when the number density of dark matter dropped. And then at a certain point, the universe was so large and the density was so low that they could no longer find each other to annihilate, and the number froze out at that point at some value here. And so we can measure that value today, and it turns out that dark matter is still around at densities of about a few per liter. So if you make a fist, there's a dark matter particle in your hand. And there are many candidates for this. One such is from supersymmetry. Thank you. But others do exist. And in this day and age, it's important to note that WIMPs are not necessarily related to supersymmetry, although they were a huge part of the story of why we like this model. But basically, we think that the dark sector, so there's some, dark sector, which here's our favorite standard model. There's some coupling between these two that we don't know. We're trying to understand what this is. But these searches are not limited to SUSY models. They're wider than that, although SUSY remains a strong motivation to do these kinds of searches. All right, so how do we find it? Very briefly, there are three sort of main ways that people use. One is called indirect detection, although really what you're doing here is you're detecting the annihilation products from regions that are still in high density today, so like the center of our galaxy. The idea is that there are WIMPs scattering around. They are clustered into the centers of our galaxy. They find each other, they annihilate, and you can detect the products from that. Here is a plot of the quote-unquote gamma ray excess from the Fermi telescope, which has been interpreted by some. This is a gamma ray excess coming right from the center of our galaxy. Some interpretations of this excess are that it is a dark matter candidate or a possible signal. There are other explanations, so it's sort of an interesting area of research on its own. But this is the kind of thing that people look for. The second thing you can do is create dark matter, say at the LHC. And so what happens there is you slam your protons together, you create your dark matter particle, but because it doesn't interact with anything, it immediately leaves the detector. And what you're looking for is some sort of missing component of your interaction, so missing ET, also called monojets. And so the LHC is doing a really good job of doing this kind of search and probing for dark matter. What I'm going to focus on today is what we call direct detection. So this is the idea that that dark matter particle that I mentioned before that's in your fist, every once in a while it could bang into something. And can you detect the product of that interaction? So that's what we call direct detection. So how does this field work in brief? The answer is that we can calculate the rate of this interaction based on some assumptions that we make about the dark matter distribution interaction. And historically in our field, so direct dark matter experimentalists, we sort of assume there's about two couplings that we look at. One is called spin independent, and this interaction couples to all the nucleons in a nucleus, and it's coherent across that interaction, across the nucleus, so you get an enhancement for large nuclei. And I'll go into more detail about this in a minute. We also look for what we call spin-dependent coupling, where it couples to the spin of the nucleus. And so this is the unpaired spin of a single nucleon. So let's talk about that rate in detail, because I think it's worth understanding where sort of the field is based upon. So I'm writing down here the differential cross-section, so dr dq, for dark matter, for a spin-independent dark matter interaction. And I've written it down as the product of four terms, and we'll go through these four terms individually. So the first term, rho over m chi. So rho is the dark matter density in our local area in the galaxy, and m is the mass of the dark matter particle. So this is literally just the number of dark matter particles moving through your detector at any given time. And so it scales because the density is fixed from observation. It scales with the mass of the dark matter particle that we don't know. And I would say, again, we get this from observation, and there's maybe around a factor of, say, 2 uncertainty in the value, but it's just a straight up and down scaling of the rate that you expect. So it doesn't really introduce systematic uncertainties, it just has sort of consequences for your interpretation of results. So that's probably the easiest part of this equation. The second part is the unknown particle physics component. So this is sigma, which is sort of the cross section for how likely the interaction is between dark matter and your normal matter. And so in an ideal case, what we would do is we would measure a rate. So we would measure R, invert this equation, and then we can understand something about the particle physics that went into that. So this is proportional to A squared for most models, and that's that coherence I was talking about before. So A is the atomic number of the target that you're using to search for dark matter. So for a large nucleus, you get a huge enhancement in the cross-section because of that coherence. Now that's true in most cases, however, again, a nucleus is not just a single particle, it is the sum of all of its individual nucleons, and so there is nuclear physics that come in here that, being a dark matter experimentalist, I try not to get involved with if I can at all avoid it. But we have to account for it somehow, and so that's what this part is doing. This is the form factor, so F squared of Q. And what this is saying is that as the momentum transfer of this interaction gets large compared to the size of the nucleus, you lose that coherence. So it's effectively saying that the de Broglie wavelength of the interaction, if it's smaller than the nucleus, then you start actually getting into the nucleus and you lose the coherent effect. And so this looks something like, to first order, a decaying exponential as a function of the recoil energy that you're depositing to the nucleus, so this recoil energy Q. And if you want to get a sense of the scale, it looks sort of roughly like that. So for large nuclei, this effect kicks on earlier at lower energies than for large nuclei, or for a small nuclei, and I'll show you that in a second. Then the last component is the velocity distribution. So this is for accounting for the fact that a fast dark matter particle is more likely to deposit a visible amount of energy in your detector, and so it's easier to see, and you get more of them. And so this is an integral over what we believe the velocity distribution in our galaxy is, and I would say that there's a lot of uncertainty in this particular component. There's a lot of, we sort of generally assume a standard model for this velocity distribution. There's a Maxwell-Boltzmann distribution, but there are a lot of people who are working in this field who would say it's not exactly correct, or maybe there's some other consequences. And so I would say, you know, my non-statistical understanding of this is there's about a 30% uncertainty, but it can have huge effects in the tails. And I'll talk about that more tomorrow, maybe not so much today, but the point is that this is a systematic that we have to deal with, although for comparing dark matter experiments to each other, we assume the same model to take out those systematics. Okay. So a word on the energy scale. The energy that we're looking for in these experiments is, say, order 10 keV. So that's not high energy by classical standards. It's actually quite low energies. And this is entirely driven by kinematics. In fact, a lot of what I'm going to talk about today is driven by kinematics. So if you take elastic scattering of things with, say, approximately similar masses, and one is moving at the speed with which we believe dark matter is moving in our galaxy, which is about 10 to the minus 3 C, and you just run through your kinematics, then you get something like 50 keV. So that's the energy that we are looking for in these events. Okay, so to sort of put that equation together onto a plot, which is easier to see, what does it actually look like? So here I am plotting the rate in counts per 100 kilograms per year for a 100 GeV dark matter particle at this particular cross-section, which is about the current sensitivity that our experiments are seeing. So this is about the limit of where we are right now. And I've done it for five possible nuclear targets. So first thing I want to note is that A squared enhancement that I mentioned before, that heavy targets have a higher rate. And xenon here is the highest, is the heaviest of these nuclear targets, and you can see its rate is the highest. The second thing I want to note is that the form factor, the nuclear component, is cutting in for the xenon first. That's why this is falling off faster with energy threshold relative to the other components, because the nuclear component is losing that coherence at a lower energy. And the next thing I want to point out is how rare this process actually is. So even in 100 kilograms in a year, you're getting maybe a handful of counts, even for the best target on this list. That's how rare this event is. And the last thing I want to say from these plots is that the rate depends, crucially, on both the WMP mass that you are looking for and the threshold in your detector. So this is for 100 GeV dark matter mass. You can see that while it is falling exponentially, it's, you know, you do get some significant rate at relatively high energies. However, if you look for a 10 GeV dark matter particle, so a lighter WMP mass, all of a sudden these rates fall off with energy threshold like a rock. And the reason for that, again, is kinematics. It's very difficult for a light dark matter candidate to deposit a visible amount of energy on a heavy nucleus like xenon. It's like a ping pong bouncing off of a bowling ball. And so that's why knowing your energy scale and efficiency, particularly at threshold, are crucial to understanding how well you're doing in this field. Okay. So here is the dark matter plot that you see in every talk you've ever seen by a dark matter physicist. And the reason for that is because it's how we present our results. And so what we do is we run an experiment, you run a detector. Up till now, we do not find any signals, and so you set a limit, and you can say where the dark matter is not. So on the y-axis, we have the cross-section, that sigma naught term from the equation a few slides ago. On the x-axis, we have the dark matter mass. And all of the curves tend to look like sort of recliners, right? A sort of a soft recliner. And they all sort of have this characteristic shape. And the reason for that is that at low mass, you're limited by detector threshold. So again, every detector has some finite threshold. And I just said that very light dark matter has a hard time depositing a visible amount of energy in your detector. So if the dark matter mass gets too light, then it can no longer be seen by your detector because it doesn't deposit enough energy. And so all of these experiments shoot up at very low, low masses. At high mass, you get this sort of linear behavior. And that's limited by the density. Remember, the density of dark matter in our environment is the thing that we can measure astrophysically or from astronomical observations. And so the heavier the dark matter, the density is fixed, so the fewer of the number of particles there are, and therefore you have less of a chance to see it in your experiments. That's why that goes up basically infinitely far in mass that way. And then the last thing in this plot is you have this sort of weird blue band or brown band. That is what we call the neutrino floor, the neutrino signal. And what that is that there are sources of neutrinos in on Earth from atmosphere, from the sun, that are also streaming through. They also have a coherent cross-section that is very similar to the one that we are looking for in dark matter. And this is about where they would set in. So if you were looking for a dark matter at 10 to the minus 49 square centimeters, you would start to pick up neutrino events in your detector. And so this is, depending on who you talk to, sort of the bottom limit on how far we can go, at least easily, again, with quotes around easily. Okay, so that's what all these, I will show more plots like this, so don't worry, you'll see it again. Okay, so I started this whole section by talking about WIMPs, where the W stood for weakly, and so the weak interaction. And so you might say, well, what are we actually looking for here? And so this is an example of the classical or canonical weak interaction, where you have dark matter interacting through Z. And you can just write down what that cross-section should be from sort of, from your quantum field theory. It's 10 to the minus 39 square centimeters. Of course, that's up here. So basically, experiments nowadays have ruled out Z exchange, and we're not really looking for the canonical weak interaction anymore. We're looking for something else. So that was ruled out a long time ago. The next thing you might do is, well, we know the Higgs exists. What if it's coupling proportional to the mass? So again, you can write down what this Higgs coupling would look like, and it turns out to be around 10 to the minus 45 square centimeters. And that's about here. So this plot that I'm showing is a little bit out of date. Our best sensitivities are sort of around, again, the 10 to the minus 46 centimeters. So we are now probing this region of parameter space. And a quote that I saw a few years ago from Neil Weiner at a conference was, this era of dark matter detection will answer whether or not dark matter is interacting with the Higgs at order 10%. So that's sort of what we're doing right now in the field. But there are, of course, models that go basically, you know, all the way down to the turtles, if you wished to do that. All right. One last comment on the sort of background of this part. So I mentioned before spin independent and spin dependent. And then there's the nuclear physics that I try to brush under the rug as much as possible. So the spin independent interaction is what we historically talk about. Most talks you see will show that particular cross section, and that's because of this enhancement. It's more sensitive, right? For xenon, you get a factor of something like 16,000 enhancement, so that's where we have the most sensitivity. However, the true interaction is unknown. So this is an old plot showing, you know, for a variety of different models, their spin dependent versus spin independent space. And you can see while many of them have both, there are some that line up along one axis or the other. So we don't know what the model is. And so you shouldn't always just, you know, rule out SI versus SD. And then going into the nuclear physics, you can actually write down many different operators, you know, the operators that you expect to see and see what their consequences are. And different targets turn out to have different sensitivity to different types of operators. So the example here is this M sub p is effectively the spin independent interaction, so the heavy nuclei do well. These are proton couplings, so fluorine, which has an unpaired proton spin, does very well. So the point is that we don't actually know what we're looking for, and so many of us are trying to argue for a broader search than some might like to fund. All right. Any questions on the sort of theory, which I'm done with? Okay, I'm going to keep going, because everybody's happy, I can tell. All right, so we look for WIMPs. And a billion WIMPs go through us every second. You might expect, you know, if you're lucky, a handful of counts in a detector per year. So what is the problem? And the problem is backgrounds. Background radioactivity turns out to be everywhere at a low level. If you eat a banana, bananas have potassium in them. Potassium is a famous gamma emitter. If you own your own home and have radon in your basement, that's an issue. Radon is probably the bane of every dark matter physicist's life. Harry might agree with me on that. If you have a Geiger counter on your, you know, in your office or a Fermilab, every single room in the lab, they go off about 100 times per second per kilogram. That is 3 trillion times per year in a ton scale experiment, and you're looking for the one or two dark matter counts that might be in there. So this is the challenge in these types of experiments. If only it were as easy to find the needle in the haystack, so to speak. All right, so what are the sources of backgrounds? One that we sort of know about and can deal with are cosmic rays. They are constantly streaming through, and so all of these experiments now go underground. So these are some pictures from Snow Lab, which is a lab that's a mile and a quarter under the ground in northern Ontario, which is a very attractive place to visit if you ever have the time. You get up at 5 o'clock in the morning, you get on the cage with a bunch of miners, and you go down. Oftentimes, because of the change in pressure, people have difficulty with the change in pressure, and sometimes scientists have been known to pass out. And the miners have a nickname for the scientists, and that is snowflakes. So anyway, they have built a pretty incredible laboratory. This is, again, a mile and a quarter underground, and there's a few of these places around the world. All right, next thing is radioactive contamination. Rock dust, particularly underground, turns out to be radioactive. I mentioned radon impurities. So there's an emphasis to get rid of this stuff on purification and shielding. So just an example, this is a picture of Dan Bauer, a Fermilab physicist, desperately trying not to sweat into the CDMS detector. This is a picture from Building Lux. You can see the great lengths that people are going to keep their detectors clean and pristine without any contamination that might bring in radioactivity. And the last thing you might have a problem with is that eventually you do actually have to build a detector, which means the detector is made of real materials, right? We can't make a fake detector. So steel, glass, if you're using photomultiplier tubes, for example, the detector components. And so what can you do about those things? And the two main things that we do are, the first is self-shielding. So the idea here is that if you have a monolithic detector volume, a lot of the radioactivity will range out in the outside, leaving a clean central fiducial volume, what we call it. The second thing that's key is discrimination. Is there something that you can use to tell the signal from the backgrounds? And here, the background sources commonly are things like gamma rays, betas, alpha decays, or neutrons. So something you can do to pull out what you're looking for. And so here I'm going to use some jargon. I apologize, but I have to use jargon. What we are looking for in dark matter experiments, generally, is a WIMP interacting with a nucleus. And then that nucleus recoils through the detector. And we call it a nuclear recoil, or an NR. And so I will use NR a lot, and I apologize in advance. It's just so ingrained in me that I cannot get rid of it. At the backgrounds, the most common background is gamma rays, and those are interacting with atomic electrons. And then it's the electron that recoils through the detector, and so we call that an electronic recoil, or an ER. And so I will go back and forth with NR and ER. But the name of the game is to try to tell apart these two things. Can you select the NR while rejecting the ER? And so most experiments nowadays do this. In fact, all of the really good ones do this. So here's some examples. CDMS, which was a cryogenic bolometer, measures charge and heat, and they play the ratio of the charge to heat off against each other for particle ID. And the xenon TPCs, which I'll talk about a bit more, and which I know you've already heard about in previous talks, again, is charge to light. And so the ratio, electron recoils have a higher charge to light ratio than nuclear recoils. And argon, which is what I did my graduate work in, you actually take the timing of the light that comes out to do this pulse shape discrimination. So particle ID, separating nuclear recoils from electronic recoils, is critical to reducing your backgrounds. All right. So if I wanted to design the perfect dark matter detector, well, what might I do? I'd take a drink of water, and then I would think about it. So there are several challenges in the field. First one, it's extremely rare. You know, we've already talked about that. A few counts, maybe, if you're lucky. So what you need for that is a large target mass, and it has to be scalable. Can you make these detectors big? Because we know that we have to make big detectors now to see this stuff. All right, you need to have a low energy threshold because you're looking for 10 keV or less energy deposition, so you need a very low energy threshold. Then you've got to deal with your backgrounds. So impurities are a problem. You have to be able to purify your detector. The detector itself is a problem, so therefore you want to be able to do some self-shielding. And of course, there are internal detectors. There are some things you can't do anything about unless you can discriminate against them using the ER-NR trick I just mentioned. And then lastly, we don't know what we're looking for, so you want to be able to be sensitive to multiple types of interaction if you really wanted to have the perfect detector. All right, any questions? Because I'm going to keep going. I'm going to have some more water while you think about it.
It looks like a mushroom cloud.
It does. It does look like a mushroom cloud. So this is a bubble chamber. This is a runaway bubble in the bubble chamber, which maybe we'll talk about in a bit. Anyway, I'm going to go into two technologies at a superficial level of detail that will leave everybody confused. So the first one is liquid xenon TPCs, mostly as represented by Lux and LZ collaboration. And the second is bubble chambers as represented by the PICO collaboration. All right, so let's start with the two-phase xenon TPCs. How do these detectors work? So what you have is a bucket of xenon. You have a gas space of xenon above the liquid xenon, and then you put an electric field on this, and then you have photodetectors at the top and the bottom to detect light, effectively. And so what happens is an interaction in the xenon creates, interacts, bangs into something, effectively, and you get a flash of light, scintillation light, that we call S1. Second piece of jargon, I apologize, but we call it S1. But you also get electrons that are freed. And those electrons will drift through the electric field. They come to the liquid surface. You extract them into the gas space, where they undergo a fast acceleration and give you a second flash of light, which we call S2. So that is the sort of main operation of this detector. And so what do you get from this? One thing you get is excellent 3D reconstruction at sort of millimeter or submillimeter level. You get the Z position from the timing between the S1 and the S2 because of the drift time. And you can get the XY position from the hit pattern in the photodetectors that you've had on the top of the experiment. And so this allows for self-shielding and rejection of edge events, which, as I've already said, is very important. And then the second thing you get is the ratio of charge to light. So S2 over S1 gives you your particle ID. And so we can do better than 99.5% rejection of ER events using this technique. And I want to say particularly that the self-shielding in these xenon detectors is powerful. And the reason for that is xenon is a nice, dense, lots of electron nucleus. And so a gamma ray passing through xenon has a lot of chances to hit something. And so if you have, say, an MeV scale gamma ray trying to get across your detector and leaving a keV energy deposition, it has to get across the entire detector before if it's not going to be seen again. And so this is a heat map of the hits in Lux. Where you can see there's a ton of stuff happening at the edges, but the center is very nice and cool. That's because the self-shielding is really powerful, and so you don't get single events in the center of the detector from this type of event. Here's a plot of the discrimination that I showed before. So on the y-axis is the S2 over S1, so just think about it as charge to light ratio. The Y scales of the two panels are the same. I'm just showing different calibration sources, and the point is that the ER band in blue is significantly above this NR band in red. And so if you make a cut sort of around here, you can reject these events. And so that's how the rejection works in xenon.
Can you say something, or will you say something about how well you understand the shape of the tail?
I will not directly, but I'll come back to it later. Okay. All right, so if I wanted to grade out xenon on my rough metric from before, So scalable, liquid xenon is clearly a liquid, so it's actually easy to get a lot more liquid in the same space. And it's very, very dense. You get something like 3 tons in a meter cube, so it's actually really nice for that. Low energy threshold. So it turns out this the signal production is extremely efficient. You get something like 70 photons and electrons per keV of energy deposited, and that's easily divisible. Purification, xenon is a noble gas. Noble gases notoriously do not react with things, so it's actually very easy to purify them, although xenon is slightly harder than some of the other noble gases. The self-shielding I've already talked about being excellent for xenon. It's got a very low mean free path for ionizing radiation. Discrimination is pretty good. And then lastly, the sensitivity to multiple interaction types. So the high A in xenon, xenon's very heavy, is great for this, but it also has some different isotopes of xenon that are sensitive to the other interactions. So this is also a very strong point in the xenon detectors. All right, how about bubble chambers? So for the younger people in the audience, of which there are several, bubble chambers were the workhorse of particle physics in sort of the 60s and 70s. They're sort of a classic tool in the particle physicist's toolkit. And what they are is a metastable liquid where the liquid wants to boil, but you have sort of denied it an easy boiling surface to boil on, and so it is metastable. And so what does that actually mean? So here, if I'm plotting Gibbs potential versus density, so at this point, I have a pressure here and a temperature here. This is a liquid state. But if you very quickly lower the pressure, so as I just click through the slides, the pressure is going to drop, and you can see the Gibbs potential change as we drop the pressure. Eventually, you get to a point where it actually wants to boil. So the favored energy state is on the other side of this hump, but because of the presence of this hump, it stays in the liquid state, and so it needs a little kick to get it over. Once that happens, it will boil uncontrollably, and you'll get a full gas state. So it's superheated here, where particle interactions can actually give it that kick to get it over the energy barrier to make a bubble. So in PICO, the experiment that I've worked on, what does this actually look like in terms of a detector? So what our experiment is, it's a glass jar, and we fill it with some target, which in our case is our refrigerants. We use CF3I or C3F8 to try and get iodine for spin-independent interactions and fluorine for spin-dependent. So that's the target. Above the target, we have what we call a buffer fluid. And the buffer we use is water. And that's there to basically protect the target from the rough plumbing at the top, which might give you bubbles and nucleation. We have cameras, and then we put the whole thing in a pressure system so that when we change the pressure in the hydraulic fluid, this bellows up here transmits it into the chamber, and we can control the pressure in the chamber. So what do? We sit at a high pressure. We drop the pressure very quickly, as I just showed in the previous slide, and here we are superheated, and then we wait. And the real, I guess, for the people who worked on bubble chambers in the old days, the big development here for dark matter is that we actually sit superheated for a significant periods of time. So this is 500 seconds. We've run for like 3,000 seconds without seeing a bubble. So being stable for that long for the particle interaction to take to hit is one of the keys in developing this technique for dark matter. So then we sit superheated, and we just sort of flash pictures, basically. We're taking pictures, the most boring movie in the world, somebody once called it, looking at nothing. And eventually what happens is that a particle will come by, bang into a nucleus, and you'll get a bubble. The cameras see the bubble, so we compress the chamber very quickly here at the end. It's a trigger, we compress, and then we reset after 30 seconds and start the whole thing again. So that's what the cycle looks like for a bubble chamber. And that's what it looks like. So this is from a small chamber that we ran at Snow Lab. This is from a neutron source that banged 1, 2, 3, 4 times. This is 10 images taken at 100 hertz, and that's what the bubbles look like. Okay. All right, why bubble chambers? Why are we doing this crazy thing? And the answer comes back to backgrounds. So I talked about how important discrimination was. And the thing is that for bubble chambers, by choosing the superheat parameters appropriately, which basically just means the temperature and the pressure, we can make bubble chambers completely blind to electronic recoils. So those are the events that come from the gamma rays and the betas, the things that are far and away the most common background that you deal with. So this is a plot of the probability for a gamma interaction to make a bubble for our two target fluids. And I think the important thing to note is that, A, the threshold is quite low, but look at how low these numbers are dropping. So in C3F8, you know, you're down at 10 to the minus 10 probability at like 3 keV electron. We just don't even see the biggest background to most of the dark matter experiments because of this property. And so
how do you measure that? Do you just put a gamma source up next to it and say, I know there are this many decays, that's not this many bubbles?
Yeah, you put a gamma source up, you simulate how many interactions there are, and you measure your rate. There's a lot that goes into this. We can talk about it tomorrow. You can see this is a bit sloppy. The overall trend is obvious, but we're trying to clean up and to get a real model of what's going on here. We can talk about it offline, perhaps. It's interesting. How does this work, or why does this work? And the answer is, actually, Gibbs wrote it down 100 years ago, or 120 years ago. To make a bubble, you need two things. You need enough energy, basically you need enough heat to get over that energy barrier, but it has to be contained within the bubble size. So remember, these bubbles are growing from very microscopic things, and so the energy density has to be localized within what we call the critical bubble radius. And we can calculate that using Gibbs' theory. And so gamma rays deposit their energy, or really electrons deposit their energy over sort of microns, which are way larger than the critical bubble size, so you never reach this density threshold, and you don't see these events. Okay. Why else? What else is nice about bubble chambers? Well, one thing is great XYZ reconstruction, where you're literally taking pictures of the events. So we can do self-shielding, and you also get multiple scattering, which is very nice to identify neutron backgrounds. So neutrons will otherwise give you nuclear recoils, just like a dark matter might. But the mean free path of a neutron is, you know, order, say, 10 centimeters, depending on the target. Of course, the mean free path of the dark matter is like the size of the universe, so you'll never get a multiple scatter from that. So you'll see multiple hits, and actually, in some of these chambers, we've seen, you know, 30 scatter events from neutron sources, which is pretty cool to see. Another thing that's nice is that we have an easy DAC analysis chain. We have no high voltage, we have no photomultiplier tubes. We basically take pictures, and we listen to events for reasons that will become clear in a moment. All right, so this sounds great, but what's the problem? Because there's always some kind of catch. And the answer here is that bubble chambers are threshold detectors. So when you see an event, all you know is you have seen a bubble. You don't know how much energy went into creating that bubble. So that makes it harder to distinguish some backgrounds, and you have less information about any potential signal. It also means that energy threshold calibrations are hard and important, and I'll come back to that point later. But sort of a case study here is alpha decays. So alphas are a type of radiation, radioactive decay. Most alphas that you'll find in these detectors are at sort of 6 MeV scale, right? Remember I said the dark matter interactions we're looking for are sort of 10 keV. So if you have any kind of energy resolution at all, these things are way off the charts, and they're not a background. But in bubble chambers, they're bubbles, just like any other bubble. And so they're actually indistinguishable visibly by eye, which was our main sort of technique before. All bubbles look the same, and the reason for that is that a 1 millimeter diameter bubble has already drawn 10 PeV from the superheated fluid, so the fact that it was MeV or KeV is insignificant on the scale of the amount of energy you've dumped in to vaporize all that liquid. So the savior for Pico turns out to be acoustics. So this is super cool, is that we listen to the sound of bubble formation, and alphas turn out to be louder than nuclear recoils are. So this is a plot we call AP. It's the acoustic parameter. It's basically a measure of the amplitude of the acoustic wave after a bubble is formed. In black here is a calibration from neutrons. So these are nuclear recoils. This is our signal. And in red is backgrounds from mainly radon decays. And you can see that they're significantly louder. And it turns out that we actually have some energy resolution through the acoustic channel. So these are the lower energy alphas, and that's the high energy alpha. And what's happening here is that a 10 keV nuclear recoil, the track there goes something like 10 nanometers, which is all contained within a single bubble. Whereas an alpha decay has its nuclear recoil plus the alpha, which goes several microns. And all along that track, there are pockets where it does pass the energy density threshold. So you get what we call protobubbles along this track. By the time we see them, they've all merged into a single bulk bubble visibly. But the acoustics are sort of getting back into a more primordial state of bubble formation, and so you see the more bubbles that were created from the alpha track. So the result is that alphas are louder, and if the sound works, which doesn't sound like it's working. Okay, this is what dark matter would sound like. This is what an alpha particle would sound like. And then I play them both together. So fortunately, oh, there we go. Okay, that was the alpha. So trust me, that was a little. Yeah, we'll do it again. It's sped up a few times. Let's try that one more time. Or not.
It just takes a while.
Okay. So the second one is louder. You may not be able to quite believe what it is. These are the actual traces. And you can see just by eye that the amplitude is much louder. So we use that to discriminate against those types of events. All right, so to grade out bubble chambers, yes?
So in your plot with alphas and neutrons, mm-hmm.
No, they're in the bulk.
Oh, really?
Yeah, those are in the bulk. So that's radon, you know, getting out of the bulk and decaying.
Yeah.
If they're on the wall, they also sound differently because the wall affects the acoustics. Sure. So we cut those optically and then.
Oh, yeah.
Because that was you can't get rid of the alphas, right? So this is a calibration with neutrons, but there's some alpha rate still in that sample. Our neutron source is not like super hot. So one thing is that bubble chambers are slow, so you can't calibrate at super high rates. So you always have some of this contamination. The other thing you might notice is this little guy. So that's presumably a WIMP.
Your calibration data.
Anyway. Okay. So let's grade out bubble chambers. All right, like, it's not liquid xenon, sorry, this is bubble chambers. So like liquid, it's dense, it's scalable, you just need a jar. So I'll give that a check. Low energy thresholds are great. We can do tunable thresholds down to like a KeV, but there's no resolution, so I only give that two checks. Purification turns out to be surprisingly easy because refrigerants are used in industry and they've developed ways to purify this stuff. Self-shielding is good. We have excellent XYZ. Discrimination is fantastic. There are no electron recoil backgrounds at all in these detectors, and the acoustics are good for alphas. And for the sensitivity to multiple target multiple types of action, the fluorine that we use in most of our runs gives us great spin-dependent sensitivity, but we can also put in multiple targets. So you can imagine, you know, seeing something and then putting in a different target with a different interaction coupling to try to squeeze out what that interaction is. All right. So, we have two techniques. Yes?
You're pressurizing the jar. Do you have to worry about the strain of the jar?
So, the jar itself doesn't see any of the differential because the whole thing is in a hydraulic bath. So, we pressurize the bath, it gets passed through the bellows, but the jar itself sees very minimal differential. But that being said, we have broken jars. Yeah. It was serendipitous. What happened was that there is in the old days, which was like 10 years ago, there was an experiment called KOO, which was bubble chambers, and an experiment called Picasso, which was superheated droplets. And in the droplet detectors, they couldn't use optics because it's droplets in like a matrix and you can't see the droplets. So they used piezoacoustic sensors as their trigger. And they noticed that alphas seemed to sound a little bit louder, although it wasn't very good. And that's because the droplet detectors, the acoustic wave gets scattered all over the place, and so you lose your resolution. When we found that, we then put the acoustics onto the bubble chamber, and all of a sudden it was like, this is amazing. So it was serendipitous. Yes, it was serendipitous.
Hugh, as long as we've interrupted, remind me, your glass is very low radioactivity, too. Right?
You can get low radioactivity glass.
It's one of the
few silica.
Right. It's one of the remarkable materials. There aren't that many materials like that. Right?
Yeah.
But that's one of them.
But natural quartz is not. So you do have to get special glass. And ultimately, if we get there, if we get there, one of the big problems scaling this up is actually you can't get glass jars that are big enough at a certain point.
Okay,
any other questions? All right. So we have these two techniques. And now we can go on and detect WIMPs. But here I'm going to give you a little bit of my philosophy on dark matter, which I don't think is too shocking. Before we can actually detect WIMPs, we have to do two things. We have to really understand our background rejection and discrimination, because if you want to claim a discovery, you have to prove that you've understood all of the things that could have faked your discovery. And you have to understand your nuclear recoil response in the detector. This goes back, to the plots from before, that if you don't know your energy scale and efficiency, you don't know what your sensitivity is. So you have to be able to know these things very, very well. What does that mean? That means calibration. So calibration of these instruments is extremely important, as it is in all of experimental physics. So again, this comes as no surprise to anybody in the audience. So I just wanted to give a few examples of creative calibrations that I particularly like that have been used in these detectors. So the first two actually come from the Lux collaboration. Lux, again, was something like 300 kilograms of xenon, 100 kilograms active, run underground. And I think they really did a bang up. I'm not in Lux, I'm in LZ, the successor. But Lux did a really bang-up job at understanding these xenon detectors better than anybody had before. And so one example is tritiated methane. So what are they going after here? They're going after the electron recoil band. Now, normally in the old days, what we would do to get an electron recoil calibration is you'd put up some source next to the detector, it would make gamma rays, they would scatter in your detector, you'd have your calibration. But I just went on like a whole spiel about how great the self-shielding was, right? And so nowadays, in a big xenon detector, an external source doesn't actually get into the detector, so you cannot calibrate your detector that way. So what they did was they noticed that methane is an impurity that will diffuse throughout your xenon volume. What if we knocked off a hydrogen and replaced it with tritium and put that into the detector? And lo and behold, it worked like, you know, like a charm. So this is a plot of their tritium, tritiated methane, which was injected into the xenon, dissolved throughout the volume, and you get this lovely beta spectrum, and they can measure charge and light yields for electron recoils down to very, very low energies, exactly the region that you're interested in for WIMP dark matter. The second thing that they did was to try to calibrate the nuclear recoil response. So here, they used a DD neutron generator, so that's deuterium being accelerated into deuterium, makes 2.5 MeV neutrons, and they put a little gun outside their detector and shot the neutrons into the detector, and so you can see the neutron beam coming in. And then the thing that they did was they said, well, we have really good XYZ reconstruction. We can measure the scattering angle of a neutron that multiple scatters in the detector. So you have the neutron comes in, scatters once, scatters again, and leaves, but you know this angle, and so from the kinematics of that angle and the energy of the neutron, you know the energy of the recoil that it left behind. And so this allows you to calibrate precisely your nuclear recoil energy scale. And they were able to do this, again, this is in like a large 300 kilogram, like real experiment, down to something like 700 EV in 100 kilograms of liquid xenon. So that's just a tour de force in calibration. Now, not to be outdone, bubble chambers also require calibration. This is something that I worked on as a postdoc. So one of the nice things about bubble chambers, you know, is they don't see these electron recoil tracks, and so they're actually insensitive to minimum ionizing particles. And so that means, unlike in, say, a xenon detector, where if you shot a muon through the xenon detector, you would be blind for several seconds, in a bubble chamber, you can shoot charged particles through them and then use charged particle trackers. And so what we did, this is at Fermilab, which fortunately has a test beam and pixel telescopes just lying around for use. We built a little test tube scale bubble chamber with a beam tube in it. We dropped that into a silicon pixel tracker. And what we did was we shot pions at it. You see the pion come down, you track the pion coming in, it makes a bubble, it scatters out. And again, from the kinematics of the angle, you know the energy that was deposited. And so this is this is a plot. It's sort of cool how this works. Anyway, so you see the upstream hits, there's the bubble, it scatters, the downstream hits. Here's the trigger in the pixel tracker. Here's the acoustics giving us the trigger in the bubble chamber. And we were able to measure the threshold. In this particular case, it was for iodine, which we could not have access to with neutron calibration sources using this technique. So that was really nice. All right, so we've calibrated our detector. Now we want to build the thing. So the next thing that we all lose sleep over is cleanliness and quality assurance. So in dark matter experiments, because we care about these very, very low radio low events, every component has to be screened and simulated for radioactivity at like a super, type A level, like everything. And so that leads to significant R&D to find clean materials. As one example, the LZ cryostat is made of the most radio-pure titanium in the world, where people went to the manufacturers of titanium and found where in the process things were getting introduced and said, stop at that process, we don't want that there. And we found something like sub-PPB levels of uranium and thorium. It's just a tour de force. Dust turns out to be another killer. It can be hard to quantify. Dust is a problem because it floats throughout your detector. Radon can come out of it. It can be radioactive. LZ has a requirement of less than 1 gram of dust in the entire system, which I guess to some people is not impressive, but to me, it's very impressive. And then you have to back that up with quality assurance. And this, to a physicist, is a little strange, because what is QA anyway? But I learned on this experiment about what QA is. And an example is from the cryostat again, the titanium cryostat, where we went to 2 years of effort to find pure titanium. And they were building the cryostat in a factory in Italy. And what we were doing was actually sampling all of the welds coming off the cryostat fab, which is pretty incredible when you think about it. And actually, we found out that they were coming in 100 times hotter than the raw material. So what the heck was going on? We stopped the fabrication, some massive screening campaign, weld a bunch of things, let's sample them. Turns out that the manufacturer was using the wrong weld tip. So we had specified in the contract to only use non-thoriated welds. These have a color code. The manufacturer thought they were using the correct weld tips, but the color code was missing, and they were actually using the wrong one. And so these were thoriated welds, and that's why they were coming in hot. So we caught that in time because we were being so crazy about our screening. And no significant damage was done. But that's, you know, that's the level of detail that people who are smarter than I do have to think about. All right. In the last, any questions? All right.
I'm just going to compliment you on having a bag of dirt is basically from the LZ.
The dirt's coming back. Don't worry.
I know.
We're going to talk about it some more. Okay. All right. In the last 15 minutes, I'm going to give you like a quick status of where we all are and what we're all doing. All right. So the Pico version of the status update. Pico is a relatively small collaboration, 17 institutions, 70 people. And this was an experiment that I lived with for many years called Pico 60. So run one was the run where I was up in Canada a lot underground for a long time. It was wonderful. I really enjoyed it, I mean that. okay, 35 kilograms of CF3I. It was the first sort of large-scale detector that was ever installed, so some people were worried about the lifetime. We were 90% live, so that was excellent. We collected something like 3.5 ton days at a variety of thresholds. This is the image that I dream about. and what did we see? We saw 2,100 WIMP-like events. While that, by that I mean events that sounded sort of like dark matter might sound. You know, they were not alphas, they were in the nuclear recoil band. Don't worry, they're not WIMPs. We know, we can tell. And how can we tell? It's because they looked weird. So if you plot, I'm not going to be able to really delve into the details, but this is four discriminating variables. So the acoustics, the expansion time, so where in the history of that expansion did the event occur? There is the Z, and this is the jar, right? Z and R squared. And so what I've done here is I'm not showing the actual absolute values of these things. I'm actually normalizing to what a dark matter experiment, a dark matter signal would look like. So dark matter should appear flat in these variables. And this is what the background looks like, which is evidently not flat. And so you can, you know, draw a box where there are no events. And the other thing we noticed is that they appeared to be high in the jar. And so again, you can draw boxes and get rid of the events. So you can cut these events. We did, you know, a very careful statistical analysis to make sure that we weren't cheating, but we did this. And you can keep about half of the exposure with no events surviving. So that's good for setting limits and publishing papers. But it's not so good if you want to be able to credibly claim a dark matter detection. And so we knew we had to get rid of the source of these events. All right, so what was the source of the events? And the question is, what was I saying about dust before? So we did an assay of the chamber after we ran it. And what we found was a lot of crap in it, basically. So silica and stainless steel are two of the biggest components in the construction of the jar, and we found a lot of this stuff. And so there was the hypothesis that maybe this is the source of some of these events, and you know, we hadn't done our QA. We hadn't done the cleanliness tests as we built this thing. So we did a run two. This time we switched target fluids for reasons that I can explain if you care. But the goal was to eliminate the particulate backgrounds while also, again, changing the fluids and increasing the target mass. So what we did this time was we cleaned and assayed to a much higher standard, to a standard. We hadn't even done anything, basically, the first time. So this is an example of the jar underground. We're basically just spraying water and detergent into that until filters come back clean. So we cleaned it to a particular standard, which basically just says that there are, you know, a small number of particles of size 50 microns or more. We also added a softer metal-to-quartz seal design because we thought that there was abrasion on that metal-to-quartz seal that might have been giving us the stuff. And we added in-situ buffer filtration, which turned out not to be needed. All right. So these are some pictures of filling that in June of 2016, and then the first physics run started in November of 2016. All right. A quick detour through analysis, since I don't want everybody to think that we don't do any analysis. Blinding and salting and bias mitigation are an important thing that people have to think about. And so in our case, we decided to go blind in this run. And what that actually means is we went deaf. so alpha events, remember, create single bulk bubbles that, for all intents and purposes, look like the signal except for the acoustics. And so what we did was we just decided not to analyze the acoustic information so that we would know we had a salting of events in the detector that we could potentially get rid of later and using the data itself to salt. So we used neutron calibrations to define our acceptance cuts, and we used all the data to define fiducial volume and data cleaning cuts. This is what the data looked like before we, you know, opened our ears. We have something like 100 bulk signals in the WIMP data search, WIMP search data set. Here they all are in red. this is consistent with the radon decay rate in the pre-WIMP search data kit, which is actually quite a low radon rate. So this is one of the lowest radon rates achieved in the dark matter experiment. We did see some neutron backgrounds. So we're not blinded to the multiplicity. We can see the events. We saw three multiple scatters, which is a sure sign that there's a neutron field that is exposed to your detector. So the multiple to singles ratio from simulation and calibration is roughly 3 to 1. So we expected maybe one neutron event in this data set. But when we open the box, so to speak, we see nothing. So in the red, the WIMP search, there are no events in the box for this run. So that's great. It means there's no anomalous background. It's also a little bit sad because there are no WIMPs either. So we did not discover dark matter. But we did set a really good limit. So here again is the standard plot, cross-section versus mass. This is the spin-dependent WIMP proton cross-section, or one of the two that I mentioned before. These are old PICO limits in purple and red, and then the new one was in blue. So PICO is far and away the best experiment in this particular parameter space. So that was a factor of 20 improvement in our previous results. All right, what's happening now? So we've shown that particulate contamination, or we think we've shown that, circumstantially we've shown that particulate contamination can create bulk bubbles. But the mechanism remains a bit uncertain, but we think it's got something to do with the buffer fluid. So if you remember, I said that we had a buffer of water sitting above our target. What we think is actually happening is that the particulate can pick up some water. The surface tension of that water around the particulate has easily enough energy to make a bubble, so a small change in that can give you an event. We're not sure about this, but that's what we think. But anyway, we got rid of the particulate and we got rid of the background, so at least that's some sign. So to discover WIMPs, we'd like to do better. And so what we're doing is we're switching to what we now call the right side up chamber. So we're flipping the jar upside down. And what in the old case the buffer fluid did, which was isolate the active target from the plumbing, we're going to do the same thing with the thermal gradient. So here is a jar. It's now all target fluid, but we have a thermal gradient to protect the plumbing from the superheated component. And so this is what we're now designing. We call it PICO-40L. Here's a picture of the pressure vessel in the jar being assembled. And we expect to be running it this summer. All right. Questions on PICO? All right. Switching back to Xenon TPCs. Where are we in the Xenon TPC edition? And so here is the Moore's Law of Dark Matter. You can see, if you are like me and really want to lead the eye, there are two slopes. This was before Xenon TPCs, and this is after Xenon TPCs. So they've really revolutionized the field and make a lot of progress. So these are the three best dark matter limits in the spin-independent parameter space, coming from Lux, Xenon-1-Ton, and Panda-X. These are all the identical experiment by technique. They're all Xenon TPCs. They just have a slightly different amount of mass. So if you want to keep going down, what do you need? You need more mass. And so that's what we are doing with LZ. LZ is going to be a scale-up by a factor of 50 from Lux to a total mass of something like 10 tons. The LZ collaboration is still small by some standards, but larger by other standards. About 40 institutions, some 250 engineers, scientists, and technicians, including several people here at UCSB. This experiment will go in the Stanford Underground Research Facility in South Dakota, right down the underground drift from Dune. A few design notes. So LZ will have more mass. Again, times 50 more than Lux, times 5 more than Xenon 1 ton, which is an experiment currently running in Italy. We'll have about 500 PMTs. We have a significantly increased H high voltage requirement. To date, no Xenon experiment has met their high voltage goals, so we're trying to make sure that we do. Xenon will circulate at 500 liters per minute for purification. I just mentioned that because Fermilab is responsible for a significant part of the circulation system. And of course, the emphasis on radioactivity, radioactivity, radioactivity. All right, here is the 3D model of LZ. With the TPC, there's the high voltage feed through, and then there's a liquid scintillator. It's interesting I should mention that, because LZ will be surrounded, or the TPC will be surrounded by a sophisticated two-component veto system. There's the xenon skin, which lives between the main TPC and the cryostat. So again, here's the TPC, which is at high voltage. The cryostat is at ground, so you need some insulator between the high voltage and the cryostat, and that is actually liquid xenon. But again, it's very, very good at shielding, and so gamma rays will range out in that space, and you want to be able to catch them there. And then backing up the skin, so the skin is another thing that Fermilab has responsibility for, so I should just mention that. But the other thing that we have is a gadolinium-loaded liquid scintillator at a detector, and that is a UCSB responsibility. Just to show you how powerful these xenon, these vetoes are, this would be the simulated hit map of events, single-site events in the TPC, if it was just the TPC by itself. So you can see there's a lot of stuff at the edges, but there is still some stuff in the middle. But if you turn on the veto, you get a lot more of this back. So you know the metrics that you can use to look at this, you either get a times 10 reduction in rate of single-site events in the detector, or you can pick up and expand your fiducial volume by a factor of 1.75. And since xenon is super expensive, that's like a $10 million gain. So that's the value of the veto that's being designed here at UCSB. All right. With the veto, the detector components, so the intrinsic radioactivity of the PMTs, the cryostat, the detector, are subdominant in the backgrounds. So let's look at those backgrounds. Here is the backgrounds table. This is backed up by something like 30 or 40 sheets in a spreadsheet. This is the summary table. My summary of the summary table is that there are 6.5 events in 1,000 days, but I don't want to be completely glib about that. So let's look a little bit at one of the components, which is the quote-unquote physics backgrounds. So these are backgrounds that are not due to intrinsic radioactivity or contamination. These are things that are like sort of real physics signals. And the answer here is that there's actually a lot of neutrinos. And a significant fraction of both our electron recoil and our nuclear recoil backgrounds are coming from neutrino signals. It's also true that discrimination or cuts are important. OK. I'm running out of time, but fortunately, I'm near the end. So this is what LZ expects to do in 1,000 days. We're going to push down by a factor of a little bit more than 50 to get down to sort of almost 10 to the minus 48 square centimeters. And it's worth pointing out that we will see, for those who care about, around 40 coherent scatters of boron-8 solar neutrinos, which I apologize if you don't know what that is. All right. It's important to be able to make discoveries. You know, we're not doing this to set limits. We're doing this to actually detect a dark matter candidate. And so I think I like to point this out, that xenon 1 ton is the experiment that's running right now in Gran Sasso. Their ultimate reach is supposedly this green dashed line. And LZ has 3 and 5 sigma discovery significance below that line. So we will be able to discover something, even if there are no hints in the field by the time we turn on. And people care about the schedule. So competition is fierce. I mentioned xenon 1 ton. They are already planning to go straight to the quote-unquote xenon n ton, which is an upgrade that's about the same size as LZ. They have PMTs in xenon. Their infrastructure is in place. They are supposedly starting physics in September 2019, although I think that's extremely ambitious. Panda X in China is also back in the race, but we want to get there first. And so my one DOE joke is that LZ is a DOE project. Some people in the audience will know what that means. All right, we had critical decision 1 in April 2015, and then we had a bunch of reviews. Then we had another review in 2016, and then we had a bunch of reviews. Then we had another big review in February of 2017. And that means we can start construction, so we're all happy, except that we still had to have a bunch of internal reviews. Then we had some more DO reviews. But fortunately, we are on track to start physics in April of 2020. But the next 2 years of actually constructing this thing are critical. So we're all working really, really hard to make sure that we stay on that track. All right, what is next? In 2 minutes, I apologize. So LZ is already going to be touching the quote-unquote neutrino floor, right? We're seeing half an event from atmospheric neutrinos in the coherent scattering channel. So if LZ sees something, that's fantastic. You know, the future is bright. Somebody will collect a Nobel Prize, and we'll be very happy that we discovered dark matter. If they don't see anything, is that the end? And the answer here is that maybe bubble chambers are a solution going forward. So this is a plot of, again, cross-section versus dark matter mass, but now in the spin-dependent space. And what I'm showing here is that the neutrino floor in this space is much lower for a fluorine-based detector than for a xenon-based detector. That's because the neutrino floor scales like the number of neutrons roughly squared, whereas the cross-section goes like just the unpaired spin. So if you have fewer neutrons, you can go a lot deeper. And so a fluorine-based detector can maybe go a factor of 100 further down than LZ or a xenon-based detector can. And so PICO 500 is a successor to PICO 60 and PICO 40L, and that is now funded in Canada and going forward. All right. Or here again is the standard plot. And the image that I have in my mind of a little bit of what's going on right now is the Monty Python foot. So Monty Python foot is coming down and smashing. You know, all of these lovely models of dark matter are all being crushed basically against the neutrino floor. And so I sort of have this weird image of like squeezing out through the toes or something. What about over here? So that's what I'm actually going to talk about tomorrow. All right, so to summarize, dark matter is one of the most interesting topics in particle physics. We have made rapid progress in the last 2 decades. Liquid xenon TPCs and bubble chambers are 2 of the best, I would say, detector technologies, and they happen to be interesting and fun. The best current limits are set by these types of detectors. LZ is poised to achieve a factor of 50 more sensitivity than the current best limits, but the competition is fierce, so we are moving as fast as I can, just as I did in this talk. Thank you very much.
told I have to pass the microphone around. So, questions? What about the argon experiments?
I don't even think I have that plot. So argon is interesting. Argon is using, for those who aren't familiar, argon, just like xenon, is a large bucket of xenon, but they generally rely on just the light channel, and they use PSDF to do discrimination. The drawbacks for argon, in my mind, are to do the discrimination, they need to operate at a higher threshold. So they don't have sensitivity to lighter than, say, 10 GeV or 15 GeV or 20 GeV. So they're not as flexible that way. They have a single isotope, so they don't have sensitivity to non-standard spin-independent interactions. And they have an intrinsic radioactive background from argon-39, which is cosmogenically activated at about a becquerel per kilogram in argon. Now, they have found ways to get around that by finding underground sources of argon or, God forbid, isotopic separation in a gigantic column in Italy. But those are still in progress. So I think it's possible that if you want to go all the way down to the neutrino floor, an argon detector is not a bad thing to do. But LZ, that fact, as a field, we're going to have to wrestle with whether that factor of 5 or 10 is what is that? What is that factor of 5 or 10 worth? Did that answer your question?
Ooh. I'm supposed to run like Phil Donahue.
What are the obstacles to scaling up the target mass in the PICO experiment?
I think the biggest one is, frankly, the jar. So we are already struggling. So I'm not really involved in PICO 500 at the moment, but I sort of try to keep my hand in a little bit. We're struggling to source that jar already, and that's like this big, maybe. So that's probably the biggest glass jar that we can find, if we can even find it. So either to go to the next level, you have to stamp it many, many times, which is doable because once you've engineered them, they're actually not that expensive. It's just a jar and some steel in a vessel. But going, if you wanted to go to larger, you'll have to develop new techniques to hold the fluid. So some things that we've thought about in the collaboration are, a balloon in a pressure vessel where the balloon is the thing that's taking the pressure across. Acrylic, we can get large acrylic vessels if they can be made so that they don't nucleate bubbles in the surface. That is R&D that is currently ongoing. You could also imagine going to just a full, stainless steel or metal vessel, electropolished to make it smooth, and then you just use acoustics to do echolocation to identify the bubble position. So at the very large scale, that probably works from a, from a positioning standpoint if you can make the technology work. So there's a few things to go forward there, but at the moment, I don't think the path is entirely clear.
More questions? Well, I have a question. Okay. This had really, it's got two sub-questions, but they're really the same in the end. One, during your talk, I was thinking, well, what if in PICO you did do extreme radioactive screening? How low could you make the threshold? But then related, because of this program that's going on, I suddenly thought, just standing here, that what if you got rid of the fluorine and just put hydrogen in there? You've probably thought about both of those, so what's the answer here?
Okay. The answer to the first question is this. So you have to do extreme radioactive screening at any point because of the neutron background. But the threshold, extreme radioactive screening doesn't gain you so much in the threshold because it's just so fast. So if you have a high gamma rate, you just move another half a kV and it drops. So what sort of getting back to Scott's question, we have some more research. People can leave if they want, by the way. I'm like over by 10 minutes. So there are new theories to try to understand exactly what's driving this. And it's possible that if for the same threshold but a different pressure and temperature setting, you can move things downward. That's one avenue. A second avenue is actually there's new recent work by our colleague Eric Dahl on a scintillating bubble chamber. And so in a scintillating bubble chamber, he uses xenon, where we now have a proposal to do argon. The scintillation takes away a lot of the energy that would have gone into bubble formation. And so the electron recoils are the things that are scintillating well, and it's suppressed. And so he's gotten down below a keV threshold in xenon in a scintillating bubble chamber, and so that could push the threshold down too. What was the second question?
Was get rid of the fluorine and put in hydrogen because it's coupled to lighter WIMPs better.
So we're clearly thinking about other targets. I think everybody is scared of the idea of a hydrogen bubble chamber underground. Now, that's not to say it's not possible.
I'm not scared as long as you do it.
Okay. Yeah.
I would never do
it. I think it's a great idea, but safety... I think it's doable, but we haven't...
I was actually thinking hydrocarbon, not hydrogen.
Yeah, so there the problem with a hydrocarbon, we've talked about that too, is something that I sort of glossed over, but in these molecules, the nuclear recoil response is not consistent from molecule to molecule. And it turns out that the heaviest nucleus in the molecule is the strongest in terms of threshold. So when I say a 3 keV threshold, what I mean is that I've calculated this threshold to be 3 keV, but the actual threshold is some shape that turns on somewhere above 3 keV and goes up. And it's much softer for carbon in C3F8 than for fluorine. So if you have C and an H, the H, I think, will be much softer, and you won't actually get the threshold that you think you were getting. That's another whole talk, if we wish.
Oh, Lord. Okay, I get it. All right. Well, if there's no other questions, let's thank Hugh again. Thank you.